shot down, the U.S. destroys the suspected Chinese spy balloon that triggered a diplomatic crisis.
The presence of this surveillance balloon is a clear violation of U.S. sovereignty and international law.
What's the fallout for the critical U.S. relationship with China? Plus, the president gears up for re-election. And trumpets a blockbuster jobs report.
The Biden economic plan is working.
But can Biden convince voters that the economy is back on track? And Donald Trump unloads on his would-be primary rivals.
Ron DeSantis got elected because of me. Nikki suffers from something that's a very tough thing. She's overly ambitious.
As the 2024 field takes shape, are they ready for the attacks coming their way? Welcome to Inside Politics Sunday. I'm Abby Phillip. At 2:39 yesterday afternoon, a tense and dramatic diplomatic crisis ended with one shot from an F-22 fighter jet.
Oh, wait, those are missiles. Oh, my God, they shot it down. They shot it down. No. You hear it?
Just off the coast of South Carolina, the U.S. took down a suspected Chinese spy balloon that had become a critical flashpoint in U.S.-China relations. President Biden had this to say shortly after the mission was completed.
On Wednesday, when I was briefed on the balloon, I ordered the Pentagon to shoot it down on Wednesday as soon as possible. They decided that the best time to do that was as it got over water outside within 12-mile limit. They successfully took it down, and I want to compliment our aviators who did it.
It didn't take long for China to issue its own response, expressing its strong dissatisfaction and protest, and stating that it reserves, quote, the right to make further necessary reaction. Those three words, further necessary reaction, beg the question, is this standoff really over? And if not, what happens next? Let's discuss all of this and more with two of our very own best reporters, CNN anchor and chief national security correspondent Jim Sciutto and Phil Mattingly, CNN's chief White House correspondent. Thanks both of you for being here this morning. Jim, this is an area that you study quite a lot, a clear escalation in U.S.-China relations at a very tense time. You're also learning some new things this morning.
Well, let's first talk about the chance of escalation. That's always the concern about this when one nation fires at another. This is a missile strike. A superpower versus superpower is what is China's response? I was reading the Global Times this morning. That is effectively a Chinese government mouthpiece. And notable to have this language in the mouthpiece. If the U.S. does not differentiate between civilian and military aircraft, then it has made a very bad precedent in treating China-U.S. relations. This piece mentions what is a fact. The U.S. has many surveillance aircraft that fly around Chinese airspace, both drones, but also spy planes. I've been on one of them. China claims that the U.S. uses civilian aircraft for similar surveillance purposes. It is telegraphing there at least the possibility that if you're able to shoot down one of what we claim to be a civilian aircraft claiming it's surveillance, we reserve the right to do the same. Whether China makes a decision to do that is another question. But some of these aircraft are unmanned, like this balloon. Is it possible that China, under certain circumstances, might do the same? It's possible. They seem to be telegraphing that. And that shows you that an incident like this is not necessarily over, that the danger now is escalation and response.
There's some clear frustration among in the administration that China continues to use this explanation that it's a weather balloon that they view as completely fallacious. And they are saying so pretty loudly. But they're also being criticized because of the duration of how long this went on. This is a balloon that traversed the entire continental United States. And you have a Republican, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, a Republican on the Armed Services Committee, Roger Wicker, saying this, allowing a spy balloon from the Communist Party of China to travel across the entire continental United States before contesting its presence is a disastrous projection of weakness by the White House. The White House owes Congress and the American people answers about this failure, and I intend to get those answers. So what is the explanation for why they didn't address it more aggressively before it was able to make that full journey?
I mean, I think contextually, you have to understand, at least according to people I've been speaking to, I know Jim's been speaking to them the same, the fact that Chinese, alleged Chinese spy balloons are in the general vicinity of the United States or in the general vicinity of Alaska is not a rarity. They've seen it regularly over the course of the last administration and this administration. They've seen these spy balloons, I think, more than five continents up to this point. What was different about this is when it was first spotted on January 28th in the Alaska kind of territory area, it actually left the U.S. territory, went into Canada, and then came back into the continental United States on January 31st. That was the moment where it became clear that this was different, and I think that alarmed some people. And that was the moment where the process inside the administration between the Pentagon, between the White House, the National Security Council, really kind of kicked into high gear about how to deal with this. The president was briefed by General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on Tuesday night. On Wednesday, the military presented full options to the president. And the president made clear this needs to be shot down. However, everyone at the table, both National Security Council and the Pentagon, said it is now over the continental United States and there is a significant risk to civilians if this very large, this was not just a balloon, this was three buses, size of three buses, a payload underneath it, that could cause real damage both to property and to people. And so the decision was made, given the fact that they believed there was no national security risk in that collection perspective, they had already moved very quickly to address that on the U.S. side, that they would let this go, shoot it down when it came over water, and then be able, in their minds, to be able to collect a more fulsome intelligence when they picked up the payload from the water, which is the recovery process that they're now engaged in.
Another point to that discussion, I'm told that General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called the administrator of NASA, former Senator Bill Nelson, to ask for NASA's help in terms of simulating what a debris fall would look like, where it might pose a danger. Those are capabilities that NASA has. DOD does not, because NASA, of course, has to consider this. If, for instance, a satellite goes awry, they have the capability of saying, okay, where might this hit on the ground? What kind of dangers would it pose? And that factored into the decision here was that you shoot something this big down over populated U.S. territory. It does pose a risk to people and property on the ground.
And, Jim, now that we have, the United States has shot this balloon down, they're collecting it. What do you think that they can actually get in terms of usable intelligence out of that payload?
Well, I'm told by a senior U.S. military official that this balloon had surveillance capabilities, but limited surveillance capabilities that the U.S. believes it was able to jam, in effect, while it was over U.S. soil. So it's not clear that this is the be-all and end-all of Chinese surveillance equipment. It did have surveillance capability. And anytime you have an opportunity to collect that, you do. I'm thinking back 20-some-odd years ago, if you remember when a U.S. spy plane, an EP-3, collided with a Chinese jet over Hainan Island. It had to land, and the Chinese kept that plane, and I'm sure drew what intelligence and technology they could from it.
It all seems to beg the question, why would the Chinese even bother to take this risk if what they were trying to, the technology that they were utilizing was perhaps not all that revolutionary.
Yeah, and I think one of the words that I heard early on in the week is clumsy. Like, it just felt clumsy. And I think that was the brazen nature of things, given the kind of cost-benefit from the actual collection perspective and the U.S. ability to very quickly move to mitigate any real threat in terms of intelligence collection, has really kind of raised not just alarms, but very real questions inside the administration, because you can't view this in a vacuum. Secretary Antony Blinken was scheduled to go to China this weekend. It was supposed to be a significant second order of the summit between President Xi and Biden last year in Asia. And to have that happen, obviously there was the cancellation of the summit. And then if you look through what was happening behind the scenes, on Wednesday night, the Chinese embassy top officials were summoned to the State Department to meet with Wendy Sherman and Tony Blinken, where they expressed their a very real displeasure.
Yeah.
And also, after it was shot down, conversations between U.S. officials and Chinese officials, basically U.S. officials saying, this is what happens, this is what we told you was probably going to happen, and this is why it happened. Now we need to figure out what the next steps are. And I'm not sure anybody really knows yet, just because of how unusual and strange this whole thing was.
Yeah. Meanwhile, all of this is happening in a domestic context. I just want to show you real quick some of the social media comments and images being made by Republicans. It's a little unserious to say that you're going to use a weapon of any kind to shoot this down.
Yeah.
But what do you make of the politics of all of this playing back in the U.S.?
Well, listen, a reasonable follow-up to all these folks is, would you shoot it down over your own state with your own citizens at risk of being hit by the falling debris? I mean, that clearly went into the decision-making here. I mean, there are open questions about whether there was an opportunity prior to it being over populated U.S. territory. But this is the nature of our politics today. We used to say politics ended at the shoreline. They clearly do not anymore. Every one of these issues becomes a partisan issue.
And I do think it really just underscores China has always been a major point of conflict for the United States. But it's about to supercharge into a major domestic political issue.
It's a dangerous time, and I think we should be aware of that. This is not a video game. This is superpower firing at superpower, in retaliation for what the U.S. views as a hostile act.
Yeah, very serious issues at play here. Jim Sciutto, thank you so much for coming in for us. Phil Mattingly, stick around. Coming up next for us, an economic shocker. The U.S. unemployment rate drops to the lowest level that it's been in more than 53 years. We'll tell you why. U.S. job creation smashed expectations this week, and the unemployment rate hit the lowest level that it's been since this classic was at the top of the charts. This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius, age of Aquarius, Aquarius. Yes, we can use some tunes this morning. Not since 1969 has the unemployment rate dipped to the stunningly low 3.4% that it hit in January, as 517,000 jobs were added to the economy. Now, this is welcome news for the White House, and it comes just days before President Biden delivers his first State of the Union address in front of a Republican-controlled Congress. And on Friday, he gave what was very likely a preview of the victory lap that he'll take on Tuesday night.
More new jobs in 2 years than any president did in their entire term. The biggest investment in American infrastructure since Eisenhower's administration, lower health care costs and lower prescription drug prices. The first black woman on the Supreme Court of the United States of America. Most significant gun control passed in 30 years. The biggest investment in tackling the climate crisis in the history of not only this country, but the history of the world.
And Phil Mattingly is back with us. CNN's Nia Malika Henderson is here as well. Tolu Olorunipa of The Washington Post and Olivia Beavers of Politico are joining the table. I bet none of you had Age of Aquarius on your bingo card.
That music video was legit. Oh, yeah. Love that.
But blast from the past, but also a really for Biden, a blast of optimism heading into the State of the Union. These are the kinds of numbers mostly that they want, although the irony of this economy is that a hot economy is kind of bad news for the economy as well. But putting that aside, he's going to tout this on Tuesday.
Yeah, I think this was a really good preview of what we hear on Tuesday night when he delivers that State of the Union address in this divided Congress. I don't imagine that a lot of House Republicans are necessarily going to cheer those numbers necessarily. But there is good news. It is in some ways a mixed bag about how Americans actually feel about it. In some ways, they feel good about the present. They're very nervous, though, about what's ahead. Is there going to be inflation? Obviously, mortgage rates are what they are and likely will tick up. So there is some worry. But listen, there's a victory lap to be had, and I think this president will have it in terms of some of these economic numbers.
Well, to that very point, I mean, just take a look at these poll numbers. Americans continue to be incredibly pessimistic about this economy. Just 20% now say that the economy is excellent to good. That's pretty much unchanged from where it was in July of 2022. And this is despite the economy really showing extraordinary resilience. I mean, what do these numbers really show? I mean, you could make an argument some of this is just a reflection of partisanship kind of getting baked into how people feel about their economic
fortune. I think partisanship. I think the inflation is a very difficult issue to address politically, even though there's been clear deceleration over the course of the last 5 or 6 months, because people are seeing it, right? In the same way that gas prices were such a huge fixation for the White House, because they knew it was essentially a political billboard every single time you drove down the street, you were seeing that this was a problem, and that's what resonates with people. And I think that's been the case with grocery stores as well, and that drives a lot of this. I think the coverage of it, the perception of it, drives a lot of how people feel about things. I think when you look at the underlying numbers, particularly given where even White House economists thought they were going to be at this point in time, This is as good as it could possibly be for the White House in terms of what they've been grappling with, how inflation has started to move downward and where growth is, where jobs are, and what they view as you heard the president kind of tick through his list of accomplishments, what is very much a groundwork laid for a very positive next few quarters when it comes to the economy based on what they did legislatively in those first 2 years. So I think all of that is factored in, but they're cognizant of the fact that there is still pessimism. And I think to Nia's point, like, there's still concern about what lies ahead.
Meanwhile, President Biden was at the DNC this past week, basically taking a victory lap and perhaps previewing a little bit of what his 2024 message might be if he runs for re-election. Take a listen.
Jobs are up, wages are up, inflation is down. And COVID no longer controls our lives. But now the extreme MAGA Republicans in the House of Representatives have made it clear they intend to put it all at risk. Think about it. These aren't conservatives. These aren't conservatives. These disruptive people. They intend to destroy the progress we made.
Biden on the attack?
He's going to be on the attack for much of the next 2 years. We're going to see some of that in State of the Union when he officially announces his re-election bid. We're going to see even more of that sort of attack dog. And sort of one of the reasons he's doing that is because he wants to not only tout his economic progress, but he also wants to talk about the contrast between what Democrats are for, what Democrats have done over the past 2 years, and what Republicans are for. And we've seen some of that in the last couple of weeks with the Congress pushing forward things like bills on abortion, bills to take care of Medicare and Social Security and potentially cut those programs. And Biden wants to say Democrats are going to save those programs and save and protect the economy while Republicans are going to be pushing things that Americans don't want.
We were just talking about the balloon issue, the balloon issue this weekend. But that plays a role in what he's going to face on Tuesday as well.
Yes. So I had a leadership source reach out to me last night, and they said that Republicans are talking about introducing a resolution basically condemning how the Biden administration handled the balloon. And if they do pull the trigger on that, that's going to be on Tuesday. So they're going to be condemning basically the president right before he comes on the House floor and he makes his speech. And so that's just, I think, one of the sort of first approaches where they're going to be trying to message against him. If you see him taking the tact of calling them extremist MAGA Republicans, I think you're going to see reactions from other House Republicans on the floor and maybe an eye roll from McCarthy. But I think, you know, it depends what Biden says.
Speaking of reactions on the floor, just a little bit of a flashback for you. Here is last year's State of the Union, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert heckling President Biden from the floor. Interesting thing about that now, you're looking at two of perhaps the most powerful House Republicans in the conference right now. Things have changed quite a lot politically going into this next State of the Union. But everyone stand by. Up next for us, Nikki Haley versus Donald Trump. The former U.N. ambassador is gearing up to challenge her former boss. This was Nikki Haley nearly 2 years ago on the possibility of running against Donald Trump for president.
Once again in 2024, will you support him?
Yes. I would not run if President Trump ran.
And this was Nikki Haley just 2 weeks ago on the possibility of running against Donald Trump for president.
Yes, we need to go in a new direction. And can I be that leader? Yes. I think it's time for new generational change. I don't think you need to be 80 years old to go be a leader in D.C.
How things have changed. In just over a week, the former Trump administration ambassador to the United Nations is expected to announce that she'll battle her former boss for the Republican nomination. She'll be the first, but definitely not the last, to mount a challenge to Trump. Let's just say he isn't too happy about it.
You know, she said numerous times, I put it up actually, that I would never run if a president runs. He was a great president, et cetera, et cetera. She said that numerous times, but she's a very ambitious person. She just couldn't stay in a seat. I said, you know what, Nick, if you want to run, you go ahead and run. Nikki suffers from something that's a very tough thing to suffer from. She's overly ambitious.
No surprises there. Trump starts with the very first thing he starts with is, I guess, a kind of gendered trope about the overly ambitious woman. And you better believe that Nikki Haley, who is pretty used to running against a lot of men, that's something that she's going to exploit. But what's her path, really, here in this race?
You know,
that's a big question for Nikki Haley, who, when she was at in the Trump administration, had pretty high approval ratings. She got approval ratings that were fairly good from Democrats and Republicans. But how does she gather enough momentum and steam with a primary audience when it's all about the heart and it's all about the gut? Like, how does she grab those folks? It's not going to be this sort of intellectual generational argument that says, you know, I'm not 80, I'm only 50 or however old she is. So, I mean, I think she's got some real work to do. Like, what is the Nikki Haley constituency?
And how is she going to answer the questions about what she said a year ago about not running against Trump, about working for Trump? There's been a lot of back and forth on Trump.
Yes.
From Nikki Haley.
So if you actually look after January 6th, Nikki Haley basically said, I think Donald Trump is done. He went as far down as he can go. There's no coming back for him. And then as the political tide started showing that Trump was making a resurrection with the Republican base, Nikki Haley changed her tune. So this is not the first time that she's sort of flipped on Donald Trump, but you have House Republicans already starting to call her out for that, and you know that they're going to be attacking her for what they call flip-flopping. I talked to Max Miller last week, and he said people continue to backstab President Trump only to elevate their platform. And he pointed to Nikki Haley, and he pointed to Mike Pompeo, and those are both people who used to work for Trump. And Miller, I would add, is a former senior advisor to Trump.
Yeah, I guess, and to his point, she's not alone in the flip-flopping on Trump here. I mean, she would not be alone. But there is some brand new reporting out this morning in CNN, New York Times as well, about Americans for Prosperity. This is the Koch organization. They are saying that to write a new chapter for our country, we need to turn the page on the past. So the best thing for the country would be to have a president in 2025 who represents a new chapter. They are saying they are going to weigh in on the in the primary, the Republican primary. They're going to pick a horse in that race, and that horse is not going to be Donald Trump. That's a pretty extraordinary move from an organization that could rival the RNC in terms of funds and resources.
Yeah, the Kochs stayed out of the 2020 presidential race. They stayed out of the 2016 presidential race. There's no love lost between them and Trump and Trump world. They think that Trump has taken the party in the wrong direction. And so the fact that they're going to potentially put their money behind and potentially a lot of money behind another candidate could shake up the race in a major way. I would expect a number of these other potential candidates, people like Ron DeSantis, who the Kochs backed in 2018, to be going hat in hand to the Kochs and saying that I am the person who can take on Trump. And there's been a big challenge among the Republicans about whether or not you should have one person take on Trump one-on-one or whether or not you're going to have a big field. This could put things in the direction of having one person with a lot of money behind them as a potential challenger for Trump.
And I think that the key on this is for the last, since 2015, it has always been, all right, fine, are you just going to sit there and wait for him to go away?
Right.
Or is somebody going to actually take action to do something about it?
Right.
And let me everyone just... has chosen the former always and has always been wrong about that. And this is the first signal of, like, actual real money coming in and trying to push the latter.
Yeah, to your very point, McKay Coppins writes a piece this week on Republicans' 2024 magical thinking, that faced with the prospect of another cycle dominated by Trump and uncertainty that he can actually be beaten in the primaries, Republicans are quietly rooting for something to happen that will make him go away. And they would strongly prefer not to be the one to make it happen themselves. He also writes in this piece that Republicans that he talked to for this story are basically whispering that, you know, Trump in old age will just go away, pass away, literally. I mean,
wow.
Republicans are telling him that.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, if not magical thinking, I don't know what it
is. Yeah, hope is not a strategy. I mean, listen, Trump is either at sort of like 25% or 55% of the Republican electorate. Maybe it's something like 35% if you sort of average it out. You know, the idea is, you know, he's a balloon, not a Chinese spy balloon, but a balloon that's here. And that he'll sort of lose altitude, right, as time goes on because of the weight of his own, you know, meeting with anti-Semites or the investigations that are going on. Or, you know, the strength of somebody like Ron DeSantis, who is in a really good position. He's, you know, maybe he's got 25% or 20% of the electorate, the Republican electorate. He can grow, right? And but the idea is, can you just wait and hope passively that this person, Donald Trump, who has such a strong hold on the Republican electorate, just fade away?
Okay, the lesson from 2016 seems to be no. I mean, just take a listen to what it was like to run against Trump back then.
I don't even know why I mentioned Jeb. You know, what happens is this. Look, it's sad. It's very sad. His family's so ashamed.
In the case of Lion Ted Cruz, Lion Ted lies. Oh, he lies.
Now you look at Kasich. I have never seen a human being eat in such a disgusting fashion.
A guy like Rubio is a baby. It's Rubio!
You know, watching that, there are two things about that. One, Trump goes on the offensive. He picks off his opponents one by one. But the other thing, I think there is really a question of the energy that you see in those clips from those years ago. Mm-hmm. You don't see that same kind of energy from Trump today. I think it's an open question.
Yeah, if you talk to the people in Trump world, they say they've got a lot of time to ramp up that energy, to do the kind of rallies that he did and he was famous for in 2016 and 2020. But he is older. He does have a lot of political battles behind him. He, if you talk to people close to him, is more bitter, not only about 2020, but about the fact that people like Nikki Haley and people that he thought were his supporters have turned against him, and people that he endorsed, like Ron DeSantis, are potentially running against him. And so he is in a position where he doesn't have that same energy, that same lightness that he had in 2016, and that may make it difficult for
him. Yeah, and there was also a sort of shock value back then in watching him, right?
We've seen this movie before.
We've seen an entertainment value.
Exactly.
I mean, it was like funny to watch, and it was interesting to watch on TV, and now it's tired, and it's old. And I think the calculation right now, to some degree, is, you know, the 25 to 30% that's baked in for him, everybody gets that. What he doesn't have anymore is the Trump skeptical folks who are willing to just say, okay, right? Mm-hmm. And so can they all coalesce together behind a single or a couple of candidates to put him in real problematic territory in a primary? And I think that's the open question right now.
Meanwhile, if you're Ron DeSantis, you're just not saying anything at all.
No, and I mean, Republicans think that DeSantis is playing it well, right? Where he hasn't announced, he hasn't really signaled that he was going to launch his campaign soon, and we're already talking about him as the number one heavyweight going against Donald Trump. So DeSantis is in a very strong place. He's trying to not alienate Trump supporters, but he's also making a punch here and there, you know, saying, well, I won re-election. So he's having his say, but I think that one of the attacks that Trump is also doing is he's trying to say that DeSantis is beholden to special interests and to, quote, the deep state, because he doesn't have his own independent money. So Trump is trying to find what works against DeSantis already.
He's still feeling it out. Mm-hmm. Well, it's about to kick off very, very soon here. And coming up next for us, though, when Kevin met Joe, the president and the speaker hold their first one-on-one meeting. How did it go? The fate of the global economy may rest on the relationship between President Biden and Speaker McCarthy. And until now, they really haven't had one. But this week, they held their first one-on-one meeting to tackle a critically important issue, raising the debt ceiling. And McCarthy says that meeting went better than he expected.
President, I had a good first meeting. I shared my perspective with him. He shared his. And we agreed to continue the conversation. I think at the end of the day, we can find common ground. I really do.
But the two sides remain very far apart. Despite that, though, Biden made it clear that he's hopeful that they can have a productive and respectful relationship.
Let's start treating each other with respect. That's what Kevin and I are going to do. Not a joke. We had a good meeting yesterday. I think we got to do it across the board. Doesn't mean we're going to agree and fight like hell, but let's treat each other with respect.
Amen. Hope springs eternal. We will see how this goes. I mean, but it is positive. I mean, I don't want to downplay this because, look, I think respect goes a long way in this town. Yep. And I think if they can get to a point where they actually deal with each other, I mean, this is in stark contrast to what we saw in the 4 years of Trump-Pelosi, two people really butting heads. I think Biden and McCarthy seem to be trying to get to a decent place here.
I think it's important to know that two things can both be true. The fact that in terms of a resolution on the debt ceiling, they're still very far apart, and neither has moved off of their positions, which are completely diametrically opposed to one another. And they can have a very positive meeting in the sense of getting to know one another better. They've known each other beforehand, but getting to know one another better and having a very respectful and engaging conversation, which by all accounts, both White House and Capitol Hill, was exactly what happened. And I think, to be frank, like, that's kind of how Biden operates generally when he meets with people, particularly behind closed doors. And what people miss in the kind of Biden-McCarthy dynamic is they're actually very similar politicians in terms of how they operate. They are people, people. They work with individuals. They have relationships. They care about the relationships. And a big part of their success is because they maintain relationships over time and understand the importance of care and feeding of those relationships. And I think those two getting together behind closed doors away from kind of the atmospherics of the political scene in which we're all living in right now is both critical and I think will be helpful down the line. I don't know how this actually resolves the debt ceiling, but I don't, to your point, I don't think you should minimize that. These discussions are important at this level.
I guess the other question that I have is when McCarthy walks back into the Capitol, can he really sell to his conference a respectful relationship with someone who many of them want to impeach?
It's going to be a tough sell. I mean, he's, you know, he has, and we saw it with the speakership battle, he has an entire contingency of Republicans who want to just be going after the Biden administration. Some are saying that they might not even support the, raising the debt ceiling at all. But, you know, if they're taking this tone, it's a good sign. But I also think that it sounds a little too rosy because time here is important. When you start having the pressure cooker getting in, that's when you have McCarthy probably in his best position to push Biden, but neither of them want the chance or the specter or, you know, the impact of the economy landing on them. So I don't know. I don't know. They're talking very, very good game, but we'll see if that sticks.
Part of the subtext here in this relationship, as you pointed out, Phil, these are not strangers to each other. McCarthy and Biden know each other. But the subtext here is that both men have been here before by virtue of their, you know, sort of like former bosses, although I wouldn't call Boehner McCarthy's boss, but they were both in the background of a conflict that played out a few years ago in the Obama administration.
I will not negotiate over Congress's responsibility to pay the bills that have already been racked up. Voting for the Treasury to pay America's bills is not a concession to me.
The president says, I'm not going to negotiate. Well, I'm sorry, but it just doesn't work that way. We've got to address the spending problems that we have in this town.
It sounds like deja vu, oh, but that is,
yeah,
this is
it
a
is.
Repeat
yeah,
of that situation is. And of some of the same players. Biden was on the Hill negotiating for Obama.
Biden was the negotiator there, and you hear some Republicans saying, listen, you're saying you're not going to negotiate, but you were negotiating back then. Listen, I think the big question for McCarthy is him negotiating with his own caucus. What are they going to ask him to do? There's talk about, for instance, having work requirements attached to Medicaid and food stamps and discretionary spending caps, as well as waste, fraud, and abuse, whatever that means, eliminating that. But yeah, there's a lot more to go in these discussions. I think the good news is some of these initial relationships and talks that McCarthy has had with Biden and the fact that the real problem doesn't come until June, right? That there is some time to work this out. There's not a real urgency yet, but there will be.
And I think it'll give Republicans some time to answer the question, what are they going to cut? Mm-hmm. So far, they have not been willing to be very clear about what exactly they want on the chopping block in these negotiations. But when we come back, as Black History Month gets underway, a first-of-its-kind class for high schoolers on Black Studies is stirring up a big national debate. But it's what the students won't be learning that's causing the biggest backlash.
The future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they maligned so long.
Author James Baldwin issued that prophetic warning about race in America almost 60 years ago. But now the literary giant, a voice of the civil rights movement, has been removed from the curriculum for students studying advanced placement African-American history. And he joins a long list of notable authors and scholars glaringly absent from the course's official curriculum that was released this week by the College Board. In Black History Month, no less, their writings, which were originally included in a draft syllabus of the class, were removed shortly after Florida Governor Ron DeSantis banned the course from his state. The College Board, though, denies any connection between the changes and DeSantis's move, stating that the course has been shaped over years by the most eminent scholars in the field, not political influence. It is not lost on all of us. I mean, we're all journalists here, understand our role in writing history, that these kinds of moves, they have a political, you know, lens to them. But in real life, I mean, the issue here is, are we really trying to teach history or are we trying to teach what's comfortable for us? And Tolu, your excellent book, His Name is George Floyd, about George Floyd, probably would be on the banned list.
I think so. I mean, a lot of these writers that were banned or taken out of this course are more contemporary writers dealing with the contemporary issues that we have faced in this country, including the Black Lives Matter movement, the aftermath of George Floyd's death, and these broader theories and these broader approaches to discussing race that involve discussing difficult aspects of our racial history, including the fact that we continue to grapple with some of the challenges that we faced in the past and that, you know, the civil rights movement didn't end racial injustice in this country. And so that's one of the challenges that folks like Ron DeSantis have presented for the College Board, because he seems to appreciate a more, a kind of discussion of race that does not deal with some of these difficult issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically whitewashing things that you don't like. I mean, it's not to say that everyone should agree with some of these topics, but the idea that students shouldn't learn them at all is, I think, what people have an issue with. I want you to listen to Nicole Hannah-Jones, the creator of the 1619 Project, on this, because in some ways, she might be the very reason why a lot of this is happening. Take a listen.
How do you have an African-American studies course that doesn't deal with mass incarceration? Why would reparations as a subject be out of the purview? We don't see these same types of fights over Asian studies, over European studies, but when it comes to Black history, we want to treat this as a political playground.
And when I say she might be the reason, it's because of the backlash to the 1619 Project that's created this fervor over CRT and whatnot. But she makes a good point. It's not. It's very transparent that this is happening over African-American studies and not all these other topics.
Right. It didn't happen around some of the other courses that are offered. Listen, I sort of take the long view of this, and it's a more positive view, which is, I think, probably in about a year or two, this course is going to be offered in states across the country, probably half the states across the country. It's a very comprehensive course from ancient Africa to Afrofuturism. Yeah. It's, you know, you should actually look at the syllabus and the framework there. It's going to open up kids to all sorts of ideas, right? In a free and open society where I have this phone, you can't really ban ideas. You can't ban Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's probably more popular because of the backlash than she would have been if it weren't backlash. People know who Kimberlé Crenshaw is. People know what critical race theory is precisely because it has been so targeted, precisely because people are trying to ban it across this country. So I'm actually excited about this course. I think it's going to open the minds of so many students across this country. It's a college-level course, no telling what they're going to do with this information in terms of further study in college and beyond. So I am an optimist in a way that I think some people are deservedly critical of the process.
And I appreciate that, because I think that is true, right? I mean, you're raising attention to all of these things, and it's going to make people seek them out. But on the political side of this, this is a long list of Republican-led states that are trying to pass laws to basically shape what kids can and cannot learn about racism and sex and sexism and all kinds of things. I mean, this is a trend that is about, in a lot of ways, playing to the base. I guess the question is, when we're getting into a presidential cycle, I mean, does this still work?
I think that it's an open question that doesn't necessarily have, on a national scale, an actual test case at this point in time. I think you could say in a congressional race scale or in a midterm scale, it didn't seem to have the effect that perhaps some Republicans thought it did. It clearly has a dramatic effect on the base, and it has become something that not just Governor Ron DeSantis, but governors across kind of red states have settled on. I think there's a very real thread here where parents coming out of COVID writ large have a lot of concerns about a lot of things and are extraordinarily frustrated. How do you tap into that politically? And this is a piece of that. Whether it's scaled nationally, I think it's still an open question.
Yeah, I mean, I think parents being involved in their kids' lives is one thing, and it's another thing for, you know, politicians to basically say, you can't learn about things that we don't like.
Yeah.
But that's it for us on Inside Politics Sunday. Coming up next here on CNN, State of the Union with Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. Jake's guests this morning include Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, as well as the top Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Marco Rubio. Thank you again for sharing your Sunday morning with us. Have a great day.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.